questions 120 in the larger and question 62 of the shorter catechism. I'm going to deal with the issue of reasons annexed to the fourth commandment. We talked about reasons annexed to first three commandments. There's something interesting and unusual is that this commandment has the most reasons annexed to it in the Ten Commandments. Of all the commandments which have reasons annexed, this has the most. And we'll talk about why in a moment, but it is one of the things that distinguishes this from the other commandments. So we're going to talk again about this idea of reasons and why God would affix reasons to commandments. This is the last commandment where we have a lot of reasoning attached. The fifth commandment will have a promise attached, but reasoning and this whole idea of argument, all of this has to do, for the most part in the commandments, these are attached to the first four commandments. These are the commandments which need a little bit more argumentation to affix them in our minds, why they're important. When we start looking at the second table of the law in a couple of weeks, Lord willing, you'll see that we're talking about commands which I think even today, at some level, people recognize the equity. They see a justice in it. They understand that there needs to be some kind of border or barrier, ethical barrier. There need to be some kind of norms or mores instilled in society. They can see the immediate benefit. The first four commandments, because they pertain to God and man's relation to God, it's not always clear to men, particularly fallen men, that these are reasonable in the same way that commandments which pertain to my relationship to other men. There's not that immediacy of reasonableness that I can apprehend. Fallen men in particular have lost touch with the nature of things as they really are. And as such, they've really lost that perception of the divine and what that entails. So until and unless God converts you, regenerates you, pulls you out of the kingdom of darkness into the kingdom of light, the first four commandments don't have that kind of immediacy. They don't seem to be as pressing. Violations don't seem like they're going to disturb and break down the entire social fabric, for example. When we start talking about the last commandments, the last six, if they break down very far, we can see pretty quickly that the fabric of society will dissolve. So let's look at the reasons as enumerated in the catechisms. And question 120, what are the reasons annexed to the fourth commandment, the more to enforce it? And the answer is, the reasons annexed to the fourth commandment, the more to enforce it, are taken from the equity of it, that is, from the justness of it, from the principle of justice which appears in it. They're taken from the equity of it, God allowing us 6 days of seven for our own affairs, and reserving but one for himself in these words, 6 days shalt thou labor and do all thy work. from God's challenging a special propriety in that day. The seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord thy God. From the example of God, who in 6 days made heaven and earth, the sea and all that in them is, and rested the seventh day. And from that blessing which God put upon that day, not only in sanctifying it to be a day for his service, but in ordaining it to be a means of blessing to us in our sanctifying it. Wherefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and hallowed it. The Shorter Catechism, question 62. What are the reasons annexed to the fourth commandment? And the answer is, the reasons annexed to the fourth commandment are, God's allowing us 6 days of the week for our own employments, his challenging a special propriety in the seventh, his own example, and his blessing the Sabbath day. So we see, they both hold forth the same four reasons. They see that we want to deal with this question again of why is it that God brings in reasons to keep the commandments. Particularly, why does he do it with respect to the first table of the law? And I've already alluded to that several times. We've talked about it in the past. God does this particularly with respect to the first four commandments because the immediate equity, that is the justness of it, the necessity of it, the benefit of it, those things do not immediately appear, particularly to fallen men. We don't see things as they really are. We see things through the distortion of sin. And so we don't see things as they are, particularly related to the true God, the God that really is. And that makes it very difficult for us then to apprehend the rationale or the reason that God would have us follow these first four commands. But as I noted a few minutes ago, the fourth commandment is particularly notable for adding more reasons than the other three commandments. So that's the first question we want to look at tonight. Why are there more reasons annexed to this command than any other? Well, if we consider first, and we've talked about this, reasoning is the method used by both the prophets and the apostles to address the people of God when they were attempting to elicit the obedience of the people. Look at 1 Samuel 12:7 and Acts 17:2.
1 Samuel 12:7. Now therefore stand still, that I may reason with you before the Lord of all the righteous acts of the Lord, which he did to you and to your fathers.
Acts 17:2. And Paul, as his manner was, went in unto them, and three Sabbath days reasoned with them out of the Scriptures.
The capacity for reason and reception of the true knowledge of God is, in fact, that means which God has appointed for the sanctification of his people. Colossians 1:9-10.
Colossians 1:9-10. For this cause we also, since the day we heard it, do not cease to pray for you, and to desire that you might be filled with the knowledge of his will and all wisdom and spiritual understanding, that you might walk worthy of the Lord, and be all pleasing, being fruitful in every good work, and increasing in the knowledge of God.
The apostle talks about this idea of being filled with the knowledge of God, increasing in spiritual wisdom. Again, and we've talked about this, but this idea of reasoning, the fact that God is arguing with us over this, points to two things. One, it points to the rational nature of the creation in man. that God created man a rational being, capable of understanding, capable of receiving arguments, being reasoned with, capable of receiving knowledge and acting upon. The Bible everywhere presumes that about man. That man is, naturally speaking, able. Now it also talks about the fact that by reason of sin, man has made himself unfit and unable to receive that information aright. Nonetheless, it's not a defect in the creature by reason of creation. It's a defect that the creature has brought upon himself by reason of sin. So God uses reasoning because man is rational and because this is the appointed way that God transmits the knowledge of his will. That is to say, this is a way the intelligent creature comes to possess the knowledge, the correct knowledge, of the will of the Creator. Through reasoning. We have to think about the information presented to us. God, in that respect, is treating us as responsible beings. There are people who want to say that Reformed theology is teaching that people are automatons, that they're robots. They miss so much of what Reformed theology has to say when we come to passages like the Ten Commandments, like, in particular, these first four commandments, where God is actually interacting and reasoning. Right? What this shows us is that God, he simply, and I've said this before, he simply could have commanded and given no reason. And with respect to some of the commandments, as we will see, that's exactly what he does. He doesn't need to give reasons because those things are intuitively obvious to us as rational men. The reason for these last six commandments that we're going to begin talking about in a couple of weeks, the reason and the equity is apparent to all rational men. That reason lies within ourselves, even fallen. There is less reason for us to argue that point. But the first four commandments respecting God, spiritual men who are spiritually fallen, are already highly inclined to argue with God. And so these commands require more argumentation. Require there to be greater consideration on our part. They require us to stop and think a little bit more about what might be either beneficial or detrimental in the keeping or the breach of these commands. So God has added these reasons, these arguments, because he wants us to obey him not simply in a knee-jerk fashion, but he wants us to obey him from a principle of reasoned obedience. He wants us to obey him in a way that we understand at some level that this is for our good and for his glory. That we are seeking an obedience that is not just reactive from a principle of fear because of who God is and the fact that we're fallen, but in fact these arguments appeal to and carry greater weight with people who are regenerate.
So is that idea that you don't obey because you don't want the, or you don't obey because you want the blessing, or, and you don't obey because you don't want the cursing, but you obey because it's right? You understand that it's right?
Well, these reasons are there to help us understand the rectitude or the equity, but they take up issues of benefit or of detriment. You know, whether or not we obey or disobey. It's not left out of the calculus. But by arguing these points, it's challenging us to look beyond all of that, that we might learn to obey God for who he is. But that goes back to the preface of the Ten Commandments. Right, so remember, behind all of the Ten Commandments, we always have that preface, the fact that God is our Redeemer. That's the big argument behind the whole of the Ten Commandments. The great reason that we should be concerned. But if we need to look for other reasons, then God is giving us other reasons here. And this command, which, although it's moral like the other commandments, this command, as I pointed out, has less of that natural rationale because it's only partly natural and it's partly positive in its composition. Leviticus 26, verse 2.
Leviticus 26, verse 2, you shall keep my Sabbaths and reverence my sanctuary. I am the Lord.
If God enforces this again and again with his authority, the fact is that this commandment is partly natural, partly positive. And that is the very reason why God gives us really twice as much in the way of rationale and reasons annexed. He's doubled up the reasons. We have, as we're going to see, reasons which appeal more to the natural, what's natural or natural moral in the keeping of the commandment. And there are also a couple of reasons that we'll see really have a little bit more to do with what is simply a matter of the will of God. You're obeying it because this is the will of God. Because this is not, this is a commandment that is least grounded in nature. This is the commandment that there is, in fact, the most proneness of men to break. Look at Exodus
32:22. Exodus 32, verse 22. And Aaron said, "Let not the anger of my Lord wax hot. Thou knowest the people, they are set on mischief."
People are set on mischief. That is, they're prone to mischief. This is the nature of fallen men. This is the nature even of men who have been redeemed, that they have a sin nature. There's this proneness. And this proneness increases as we move further and further away from the center of that natural receptivity of the law. In other words, the last six commandments are more naturally resonating within you simply by reason of being a creature, like other creatures. The first four commandments having natural resonance, but because they respect God, they need a little bit more enforcement. Because sin has widened that gulf between creation and the Creator. We need more encouragement. But the fourth command of all those commands is the one most distant, that least resonates, because it's partly natural moral and partly positive moral. So part of it we can understand from a principle of regeneration in particular, but the positive aspect of it is still elusive. And our sin nature is highly resistant. Men are most prone to break those commands which seem most distant or remote from them. And the fourth commandment is that commandment. It's the door by which they break the first three commandments continually. But when they break the other three commandments, that actually occurs to them that they're breaking those commandments more than it will occur to them that they're breaking the fourth commandment. Because there is a witness in nature, a clearer witness in nature. So because the fourth commandment is this composition, we need more reasons. These reasons then are given that its violation would be made the more inexcusable. Look at Romans 1:20 and John 15:22.
Romans 1:20, for the invisible things of him, the creation of the world, are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse.
John 15:22. If I had not come and spoken unto them, they had not had sin, but now they had no cloak for their sin.
Okay, so Paul says that, first of all, what is available to men through nature is apparent to all. And as we've said, there are aspects of this commandment that are available to all men naturally. Now, they suppress that truth in unrighteousness, but there is this additional aspect of this commandment which requires more than that. It requires God speaking to us, God telling us what it is we need and why. And the fact that we've been told leaves us more inexcusable. The positive aspect of this command, we're not left at any level, because we're not able at any level, to ferret out its meaning, its intention, that's revealed to us. And the argument really should end there. When we want to argue the point, we're more inexcusable. We've become more inexcusable with regard to the entire command, as a matter of fact. Not just with respect to what is positive, but that is positive moral, but what is positive natural as well. But nonetheless, we have to say this. Christianity, being a reasonable faith, 1 Peter 3:15.
1 Peter 3:15. But sanctify the Lord God in your hearts, be ready always to give an answer to every man that asketh you a reason of the hope that is in you, with meekness and fear.
The reason we can give a rational response, an answer, is that Christianity is reasonable. Christianity is not presenting us with a number of things to be believed that are simply fantastical and would strain the average person's credulity. It strains the credulity of atheists and agnostics, but that's because, again, these are people suppressing the truth in unrighteousness. They they deny the very ground of reasonableness being in man, that it's concreted in man. Right. Nonetheless, we can see Christianity gives us an appeal not only to the nature, but to the reasonableness of the will of the Lord given in this command. Look at Romans 12:1.
Romans 12:1. I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable unto God, which is your reasonable service.
What we're being asked to do is is by the apostle characterized as reasonable service. God is not asking us to be unreasonable, to do something unreasonable. And that's what the point of these four reasons that we're going to talk about next. The very point, the underlying point is, even though this command is a composite, being partly moral natural and partly moral positive, yet altogether, what we're being asked to do in keeping Sabbath is not unreasonable. It's not in any way the imposition that people tend to view it. A lot of people, when you talk to them and tell them that you block out the Lord's Day, that you're not traveling, you're not doing this, you're not doing that, you're not going to be doing secular work, you're not going to be engaging in a number of activities, you're not going to be conducting the business of the world, and so on. A lot of people view that as a huge impediment to normal living. And what we want to do really is counter that notion, that what God is asking us to do is reasonable. It's reasonable both from the point of view of the nature of things, as we will see, and also by reason of the will of God. The will of God itself, even if we can't discern a reason behind it, and we don't need to, even if it hasn't been revealed to us, even if there were not to be a rationale comprehensible to us, there should be a working assumption that the will of God is inherently reasonable. And we'll look at why that is, particularly with regard to this commandment, in a few minutes. But I want you to think about that. When God asks us to do something, positive law is like God commanding not to eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. There's nothing natural about that. It's moral, but it was positive. It would have been absolutely impossible for you at the time, at that moment of time, to discern any principle of equity from the command. But what we're saying is this. In this command, God actually ties to his will certain promises, certain expectations, which turn that act of willing, that is the divine will, what is positive about this law, turns it into additional arguments for you to keep the law. He could simply have said, like he did in the garden, that's what I told you to do. But as we see in the garden, there actually is a little bit more to that. And that is, he tied to it a promise and a threat. That is, he turned that act of his will, the command of his will, into a covenant. When we talk about the Sabbaths as being signs of God's covenantal relation, we will see in a little bit that in fact that same kind of relationship is in view in this command and in the reasons given in this command. All right, the second question then is, what is the first reason given? The first reason is taken from the equity of the command. That is, the justness, that internal principle of rectitude in that command, whereby God allows us 6 days for our own business and reserves but one day of the week for himself. Look at Exodus 20, verse 9.
Exodus 20, verse 9. 6 days shalt thou labor and do all thy work.
6 days shalt thou labor and do all thy work. God has given us 6 days. He's reserved one day. One day out of seven. 7 days in a week, six of them, he says, you can have them to do all of your lawful business. I want one day put aside. Now, the strength of the reason here lies in the fact that it would be, in fact, highly unreasonable and highly ungrateful to begrudge a seventh part of time for his immediate service. Look at 2 Timothy 3, 2.
2 Timothy 3:2. For men shall be lovers of their own selves, covetous, boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy.
Paul complains that men would be unthankful, and it would be the height of unthankfulness if God says to you, you can have six parts of seven of something, and you say, no, I want all seven. That is, in fact, an there is embedded in that an absolute casting off of any kind of holy restraint, any kind of consideration of what is just and equitable. People who think they deserve every day of the week to themselves, for their own business, are spiritual ingrates. They exhibit very clearly in the behavior a complete lack of sense of the divine. Right? Nonetheless, and like our first parents in refusing to abstain from one tree when they were allowed to use all of the rest, this ingratitude appears. Look at Genesis 3, verses 2, 3, and 6.
Genesis 3, 2, 3, and 6. And the woman said unto the serpent, we may eat of the fruit of the trees of the garden, but of the fruit of the tree which is in the midst of the tree, God said, ye shall not eat of it, neither shall ye touch it, lest ye die. 6. And when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, and that it was pleasant to the eyes, and a tree to be desired to make one wise, she took of the fruit thereof, and did eat, and gave also unto her husband with her, and he did eat.
Okay, so it's not wholly unlike, and when Paul says that we sin after the similitude of Adam, men most naturally do, in fact, sin after the similitude. What is the similitude? Well, they had access to every tree in the garden but one. And what tree is it that catches their attention? What tree is it that they simply cannot resist? What tree is it they feel the need to touch, to take the fruit, and to eat the fruit? You have everything else. It's the same principle with Sabbath keeping. You've been given the lion's share of the week, 6 days out of seven. And you can't keep your hands off of one day a week. You can't restrain yourself from violating this command. You can't remove yourself from that kind of temptation. It's ingratitude. It's a spiritual ingratitude, and it is in fact very much the kind of sin which is after that similitude that our first parents sinned. You have everything else. You've been asked to refrain from one thing, and you still can't do it. This is probably another reason why this is the command that men are least cognizant of breaking. They just don't see the importance, because they are, part of being spiritually blind is being spiritually arrogant and ungrateful. Now the force of the reason then lies in several considerations. We want to consider several things here to look at exactly how insane you must be in your sin to fail to take note of the gravity of a breach of Sabbath. All right. The first is, we have time enough to serve ourselves in 6 days. And isn't it only just or equitable to serve God upon the seventh day? Look at Isaiah 56, 1 and 2.
Isaiah 56, verses 1 and 2. Thus saith the Lord, keep the judgment and do justice, for my salvation is near to come, and my righteousness to be revealed. Blessed is the man that doeth this, and the son of man that layeth hold on it, that keepeth the Sabbath from polluting it, and keeping his hand from doing any evil.
Without getting into other reasons which we're going to talk about, I think if you consider simply the calculus of equity, God has given us not just twice as many days as he's reserved to himself, but six times as many days as he's reserved to himself. He didn't need to do that. He did that for our benefit. He did that out of consideration for us. And that is precisely why there is an issue of equity involved here. When someone has given you six parts of something out of seven, and has asked you simply to reserve that seventh part, there's an inherent equity. I mean, the justness of asking you simply to refrain from putting your hand to that seventh part should be apparent to anyone with any sense of civility, any sense of what is right. We're going to come back to that in a minute, but I just want you to begin to think about that. Right? The second consideration here is that we have time enough to tire ourselves out upon 6 days in laboring. And isn't it a kindness to both body and soul to be obliged to rest upon the Lord's day? Look at Deuteronomy 5:14.
Deuteronomy 5, verse 14, but the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord thy God. In it thou shalt not do any work, thou, nor thy son, nor thy daughter, nor thy manservant, nor thy maidservant, nor thine ox, nor thine ass, nor any of thy cattle, nor thy stranger that is within thy gates, that thy manservant and thy maidservant may rest as well as thou.
When we consider the wear and tear, the toil, the nature of the toil, to be told to take 1 day a week off to consider other things, isn't, just from a principle of equity, isn't there something not only inherently reasonable in that, but isn't there a great kindness in that? Is there something about this commandment that should be striking people as being harsh and foreboding and driving you away? What is it that is so unreasonable about this, that so many people have such a difficult time abiding by it? Right, third, there's enough time in these 6 days to raise our appetite for spiritual rest and refreshment, being that it returns so seldom, and therefore we ought to rejoice in its return. Look at Psalm 118:24.
Psalm 118:24. This is the day which the Lord has made. We will rejoice and be glad in it.
We ought to rejoice and be glad in the day. Why? Again, God has given us 1 day in 7, which is a day of spiritual refreshment as well as bodily rest. It doesn't happen so often that you should be growing weary of it. That is, that you feel like it's just another day that's a waste of time. You literally have 6 days to wear yourself out in whatever other endeavors you need to accomplish. You have 6 days in which to grind it out. It's not like every other day is a Sabbath. It's seldom enough that you ought to appreciate it. We know enough, in fact, physiologically, that we know that men respond better to these cycles of 7. We know that. We know that men are more productive, just from an economic point of view. From a health point of view, we know that men reap great health benefits. It lowers the amount of stress. It lowers the amount of wear and tear. Those are just practical concerns, but all of this should figure into this equation when you're thinking about the equity. And the fact that you very often don't have a lot of excess time during those other 6 days to devote to spiritual pursuits ought to make believers in particular to rejoice, knowing that 1 day a week can be especially devoted, can be used especially for these kinds of purposes, pursuing spiritual growth. But the last consideration And I think that this really puts a lot of this into perspective, is the Lord might have taken 6 days and allowed us one day, and none could have quarreled with him. Look at Daniel 4:35.
"For and all the inhabitants of the earth are reputed as nothing, and he doeth according to his will in the army of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth, and none can stay his hand or say unto him, What doest thou?"
We're not in a position to quarrel with God. Had he done it some other way, we couldn't really quarrel the point. There'd be no argument. He would have only done what was, again, just, equitable. But when he gives you more rather than less, well, then we need to ask ourselves, shall we, as those who are rich, take from that poverty which he's reserved unto himself? Are we going to take that wee bit that he's reserved for himself, that lesser thing? He's given us all of the riches of 6 days, reserved for himself the poverty of one day. And we're going to take that. Look at 2 Samuel 12, 2 to 6.
2 Samuel 12, verses 2 through 6. "The rich man had exceeding many flocks and herds, but the poor man had nothing, save one little ewe lamb, which he had bought and nourished up, and grew, and it grew up together with him and with his children, and it did drink of his own meat and drank. It did eat of his own meat and drank of his own milk, and lay in his bosom, and was unto him as a daughter. And there came a traveler unto the rich man, and he spared to take of his own flock and of his own herd to dress for the wayfaring man that was come unto him, but took the poor man's lamb and dressed it for the man that was come to him. And David's anger was greatly kindled against the man, and he said to Nathan, As the Lord liveth, the man that hath done this thing shall surely die, and he shall restore the lamb fourfold, because he did because he had no pity."
The aggravation of the one in this parable is precisely because he had great flocks, and he still took the one ewe lamb from the poor man. God has given us 6 days out of seven, and we still want to take that seventh day. Isn't that the same kind of egregious overreach, that same kind of ingratitude, the same kind of covetousness, that same insatiable appetite for what really wasn't ours, isn't ours, but God has reserved to himself? Where is it that men cannot see the equity of God reserving one day in seven? All right, the second reason. What is the second reason given? Question three. The second reason is taken from God's challenging a special propriety in that day. Look at Exodus 20, verse 10.
Exodus 20, verse 10. "Seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord thy God. In it thou shalt not do any work, thou, nor thy son, nor thy daughter, thy manservant, nor thy maidservant, nor the cattle, nor the stranger that is within thy gates."
Okay, God challenges, or basically, he puts forth the notion in the command itself that there is something peculiar about this day. Now that should make us pause again. Although all days and even time itself belongs unto God, look at Ephesians 5:16.
Ephesians 5, verse 16. "Redeeming the time because the days are evil."
We have to redeem the time. Why do we have to redeem the time? Well, because the days are evil. Why are they evil? Because of sin. The days, all the days belong to him. He wants us to redeem them. But this is a day that specifically, in a peculiar manner, this is a day that is his. Look at
Revelation
1:10.
Revelation 1:10. I was in the Spirit on the Lord's day and heard behind me a great voice as of a trumpet.
It is the day that is peculiarly designated the Lord's day. That indicates a special propriety, that he is making a special claim. He's advancing a peculiar claim with regard to one day in seven. In fact, he specifically calls Sabbath days his own. Exodus 31:12-13.
And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, Speak thou also unto the children of Israel, saying, Verily my Sabbaths ye shall keep, for it is a sign between me and you throughout your generations, that ye may know that I am the Lord that doth sanctify you.
He calls Sabbath days his own. They're my Sabbaths, he says. That's a special propriety. When we talk about proprietary right, we talk about the right, a peculiar right that someone has with regard to some thing and its use. A lot of companies have proprietary right with respect to logos, names, trademark. It's a proprietary right. God has established this kind of proprietary right in the Sabbath day. Out of all of the days, he could challenge a proprietary right to all of the days because all time is his. He could challenge a proprietary right to your entire life, because it belongs to him. All souls are his. He says so. But he challenges a peculiar, that is, a proprietary right in the Sabbath day. He is, in fact, enjoining, commanding, and commending a particular and peculiar use of that time. He's restricted you from using it the way you want to. He's given you 6 days. We talked about the equity. But in addition to the equity, he has, beyond that, not just reserved one day of seven, but he's reserved it in a way that he set his mark upon it. This is why Sabbath keeping is, in fact, tied to the covenant. It's a sign of the covenant. The strength of the reason lies in the fact that God is a gracious God, makes a grant of himself to us in the covenant of promise, in which he claims this day as his own, and gives us this great privilege to have communion with him on it. Isaiah 58:14.
Then shalt thou delight thyself in the Lord, and I will cause thee to ride upon the high places of the earth, and feed thee with the heritage of Jacob thy father, for the mouth of the Lord hath spoken it.
It's a proprietary right. He's going to feed thee in it. He's going to cause you to ride upon the high places of the earth. Why? How? Well, verse 13, which we'll look at in a moment. That verse, we can see that the context has to do with Sabbath keeping. It's this particular day, each week, wherein God has made a peculiar promise, not just that common promise of covenanted mercies, but in this day in particular, he has promised to make himself known in, to, and by his people in a peculiar way. And a large part of this has to do that with this fact, that there is a privilege here of having a foretaste and grace of what shall be more fully enjoyed in glory hereafter. Look at 1 Corinthians 13:12.
1 Corinthians 13:12. For now we see through a glass darkly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, but then shall I know even as also I am known.
Remember, the whole idea of Sabbath is pointing to eternity. Keeping of Sabbath is pointing to glory. So you are given an opportunity to experience God and His mercy in grace in a way that anticipates that heavenly glory, that eternal glory. It's a pause. There's a pause in your time for the week. Every week you're given a pause. The time to reflect not only upon what you've done and where you are in life, but most particularly to reflect upon all of life in light of eternity. That's why this is a peculiar or proprietary right that God is expressing in this day. This is the day that He has made by the resurrection of the Son of God. This is the day wherein He declares His grace and the privileges of His covenant to His people. This is the day that His people gather to remember not only what He has done, but what He shall do for their salvation. There is a heavenly anticipation. That is proprietary. Nothing else. There's nothing else in this life that has that kind of right attached to it. That is to give you a foretaste of heaven. A foretaste of that kind of glory. The force of this reason appears then in the following. First of all, if we have a God, it's only reasonable, isn't it? There should be time set apart for His service. Look at Deuteronomy 5:15.
Deuteronomy 5:15, and remember that thou wast a servant in the land of Egypt, and that the Lord thy God brought thee out thence through a mighty hand and by a stretched out arm. Therefore the Lord thy God commanded thee to keep the Sabbath day.
Yeah. Why is He commanding this? Because He is the God who redeemed us. That's a proprietary right, not only the day, but over His people. They are His people. He is their God. That's a proprietary right. Again, when a company can say, this is our trademark, it means it belongs to them and it's for their use and their use alone. No one has the right to use it without their permission. That's what God has established in the Sabbath. He's established it in His people. He's established it in the Sabbath. And when His people are gathered together on the Sabbath, there is a peculiar and even a pronounced intersection of this proprietary right in people and day. They've been peculiarly pulled out of the kingdom of darkness, removed from the kingdom of Satan. Why? To worship God and glorify Him forever. And that task, which will be the great task of eternity, they begin and they practice every Lord's Day. That's proprietary. There is a special propriety then in this day. It's the day that anticipates eternity. It's the day that all men should be very careful to take heed. Be very careful to keep. Why? All men will face eternity. God's judgment begins in the house of God. It begins in the gathering of His people. Through the preaching of the word, through the administration of sacraments, through discipline, people of God are judged. God is continually judging His people, sifting His people, preparing them for eternity. When men do not observe Sabbaths, they're not being prepared. Hell will be full of people who are not prepared for eternity. It will be the keynote of hell. All right, second, it is a sacrilegious robbing of God to steal from Him the time consecrated to His use by profaning the Sabbath. Look at Proverbs 20, 25 and Malachi 3, 8.
Proverbs 20, verse 25, is a snare to the man who devours that which is holy and after vows to make
injury.
Malachi
3, 8, will a man rob God? Ye have robbed me. Ye say, wherein have we robbed thee? In tithes and offerings.
There are a lot of ways that men can rob God. They rob Him when they don't give Him what belongs to Him. And in this case, we're talking about Sabbath. When men devour that which is holy, that is, when they use it for their own purposes, it is a snare to them. There is a profaneness. It is sacrilegious. It's contrary to what is good and holy and righteous and just. To take that which God has appointed for a peculiar use and to turn it into a forum for anything but that use. It's a sign of the great profanity of this nation and the nations of the earth, that they have appointed all of these public events, sporting events and cultural events, to transpire on the Lord's Day, so as not to interfere with their normal course of work, so that more people can ignore the Lord's Day and misuse it. It's just an example. It's an exhibition of how wicked and profane a society has become. It's a robbing of God. He's given you 6 days a week to use for your purposes, and you feel the need to take that day that He's reserved to Himself and use it the way you see fit. It's robbery. One of the arguments that the Reformers had against the Papists when it came to celebration of holy days was that they were taking days away from men, wherein they were supposed to be working, wherein they could conduct their business and take care of their affairs, and forcing them to avoid dealing with their worldly affairs one additional day a week. Or in certain cases, 12 days in a row. That was objected to by a lot of, particularly the Scottish Presbyterians, as being a robbing of man. Taking away from men days wherein they could be productive, days wherein they could increase their own earthly estate, to their, not just to their own benefit, but to the benefit of the church. And yet, as just as that was, it's a much greater objection that men take this day that God has set aside and rob him of this time and give no consideration to the fact that God would have us use this day for his glory and for our good. That brings us then to question four. What is the third reason given? The third reason is to be found in the example of God, who, though he might have created everything in a moment, yet used 6 days and rested upon the seventh. Genesis 2:2.
Genesis 2, verse 2, and on the seventh day, God ended his work which he had made, and rested on the seventh day from all of his work which he had made.
In a moment, we're going to come back to that point, but it's very interesting. This is the first time in the Bible, with regard to the Sabbath keeping, it's the first time in the Bible that we see a pause in the narrative, and we're being pointed to a divine example . Our attention is being called to what God does, and it's being called to it in such a way as to point out something normative. God could have created everything in a moment. He didn't do that. Why didn't he do that? We never confront that issue head on until we come to this verse in Genesis 2. It's not something that is immediately apparent until we get to this point. And then you have to ask yourself, wait a minute, did God need to rest? What's going on here? So there was a controversy in the early church over, well, did God create in 7 days? Or, as Augustine said, did he create in a moment of time, but it was revealed to us by way of accommodation as 7 days? Augustine's argument is very different from people who want to turn 7 days into 7 billion years. It's a very different argument in view. The point is that no matter which way we go with this, it's revealed to us as 7 days, and that's clearly, as Calvin would point out, accommodating language. We have no reason to believe that God didn't do it. He said he did it in 7 days. But if we stop and reflect upon it for a moment, it should be very apparent to us. Well, God certainly could have done this in a moment. Why does he do it over the course of 6 days and rest on the seventh? And the only reasonable answer is that he did it as an accommodation to teach man something. Because very clearly God could have created everything in a moment of time, and he certainly didn't need to rest 1 day in seven. And note that. And so that example then, which is brought up here in the Catechism, is an important one. The example, in fact, is rolled into the commandment as we read in Exodus. Deuteronomy, the references to the Exodus, redemption from Israel, or the redemption of Israel from Egypt. But in Exodus, it's pointing back to creation. So we see there then a divine example. And the force of the reason then is to be found in this. First of all, God's imitative example is a most binding rule. Look at Ephesians 5:1.
Ephesians 5, verse 1. Be ye therefore followers of God as dear children.
We're to be followers of God as dear children. Well, how is it we can follow God? You know, it's very popular now, those wristbands, what would Jesus do? This could be very complicated for us if we say, oh, we're going to follow God. Well, God created the world. How can we do that? Now, that's not exactly what's in view. The fact is, when God works in a way of accommodation to our estate, it often provides an example which is imitative. Look at Matthew 5:45, for example.
Matthew 5, verse 45. That you may be the children of your Father which is in heaven, for he maketh his sun to rise on the evil and on the good, and sendeth rain on the just and on the unjust.
Jesus appeals to God's common providences as a reason why we ought to be kind and just to everyone, regardless of whether or not they're believers. Why? Well, Jesus says God is. There's a common providence that affects all men. And that's imitative. Why is it imitative? Because, again, this is an example of condescension. God could immediately attach his disapprobation to the reprobate, make clear that he hates them at every point, and that we should steer clear of them. He could mark them with big red signs that say, keep away. He doesn't do that. With this matter of Sabbath keeping, again, I go back to the fact that God could have created in a moment of time. He didn't do that. The limitation was not in himself. Rather, the accommodation is on our behalf. And that's what makes it an example. The limitation is not in himself when Jesus makes this appeal. Now, there are things that God does that very clearly are beyond our capacity. On the other hand, there are things that God does and are revealed to us in Scripture that are accommodated to our estate. And those things are instructive. Those things we often can imitate. Those things do inform us about the nature of God and the nature of societies in general. In the case of Sabbath keeping, the fact is we're told God rested one day in seven, and that clearly is not for his own benefit. It's clearly to hold forth an example for us. All right, the second consideration is this. Because God rested and took complacency in his works on the seventh day, profaning of the Sabbath is indicative of an eminent and signal contempt for God and his works. Look at Psalm 139:14 and 143:5-6.
Psalm 139, verse 14. I will praise thee, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Marvelous are thy works, and that my soul knoweth right well.
Psalm 143:5-6. I remember the days of old. I meditate on all thy works. I muse on the work of thy hands. I stretch forth my hands unto thee. My soul thirsteth after thee as a thirsty land. Selah.
The psalmist meditates upon God's works. What does God do on the seventh day? He rests, and he's presented as in a state of complacency. That is, he's just sort of soaking in what he's done. He pronounces it all very good. And he's pleased. Picture is very anthropomorphic. He's displaying himself as being pleased with himself. He's pleased at what he's done. This is a good thing that I've done. When we fail to keep Sabbath, we fail to contemplate things in the very way God did in the beginning. It shows a contempt not only for the divine, but for God's works in creation and redemption. There's an utter contempt going on. Not only are we failing and showing contempt for the example that God has set for us, but we are failing to appreciate and apprehend and taking that kind of delight or pleasure in meditating upon what God has done in the works of creation and redemption. And yet, if we compare the account in Exodus 20 and Deuteronomy 5, the Sabbath day, and the part of the rationale that shifts from the one account to the other is this contemplation of creation and redemption. God would have us meditate upon these things, to learn to take the same kind of complacency or satisfaction in those things that he does. Creation is very good. The problem is not creation, the problem is sin. It's not the creation. Redemption is very good, because sin is so bad. Redemption is very good. We ought to take that same kind of satisfaction, that pause in life, to reflect upon not only the good creation that man has destroyed by way of sin, but the restoration of its goodness in redemption. And yet this is exactly what men fail to do when they fail to follow God's example. Right, question 5. What is the fourth reason given? The fourth reason, the last reason, is discovered in the blessing which God has put upon the Sabbath day and its keeping. Look at Exodus 20, verse 11.
Exodus 20, 11. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea, and all that in them is, and rested the seventh day. Wherefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and hallowed it.
The Lord blessed the Sabbath day and he hallowed it. That is, he sanctified it. He set it apart. He set his mark upon it and he blessed it. And what this imports is God's honor by its keeping is displayed in such a way that God promises to shower upon his people his blessings. The rejection of which is akin to Esau's rejection of the blessing. If we look at Hebrews 12, 16 and 17.
Hebrews 12, verses 16 and 17. Lest there be any fornicator or profane person as Esau, who for one morsel of meat sold his birthright. For you know how that afterward, when he would have inherited the blessing, he was rejected. For he found no place of repentance, though he sought it carefully with tears.
This is a day wherein God has promised a blessing. Are you going to reject that blessing? What makes you any different than Esau? Why should you think of yourself as any different than Esau? Esau is the prototypical person who rejects the blessing of God in the Bible. God has blessed this day. He set this day apart. You're rejecting that honor that he's placed upon that day by blessing it and hallowing it, promising a blessing to those who keep it. But it also imports our own interest, whereby the good that we receive by its observance far outweighs the penalties God attaches to those who profane it, lest they should lose time. Nehemiah 13:18.
Nehemiah 13:18. Did not your fathers thus, and did not our God bring all this evil upon us and upon this city? Yet you bring more wrath upon Israel by profaning the Sabbath.
The fact is that profanation of the Sabbath is fraught with danger, spiritual danger. God threatens it with a curse, particularly upon his people. One reason the church today is so weak, one reason the church is blasted, is that there is no concern for Sabbath keeping. Men have no regard for the Sabbath, just like any other day for them. Even professing Christians. You lose the blessing. Sabbath observance far outweighs, the blessings of Sabbath observance far outweighs any penalties that you're going to incur. Because while the world may penalize you in some way, you have to understand that God will positively curse you. And the force of this reason should be apparent because, first of all, the Lord put a peculiar honor upon this day above all others. It is holy of the Lord and honorable. Look at Isaiah 58:13.
Isaiah 58:13. Thou turn away thy foot from the Sabbath of doing thy pleasure on thy holy day, and call the Sabbath a delight. The holy of the Lord, honorable, shall honor him, not doing thine own ways, nor finding thine own pleasure, nor speaking thine own words.
What is the blessing? Well, this day we're told is holy of the Lord. It's honorable. Honorable. Why? Because God has placed his blessing upon it. He's marked it off. You're going to reject that honor, that blessing? God has given it a special mark, and he tells us it's holy of the Lord. That is, it's set apart of the Lord. He's the one who set it apart. He's the one who's made it honorable. There's a blessing in it. Right. Second, the Lord has set it apart for spiritual blessing to his people, so that in the sanctification of that day there's to be found blessing. Isaiah 56:6-7.
Also the sons of the stranger that join themselves to the Lord, to serve him and to love the name of the Lord, to be his servants, every one that keepeth the Sabbath from polluting it, and taketh hold of my covenant, even them will I bring to my holy mountain, and make them joyful in my house of prayer. Their burnt offerings and their sacrifices shall be acceptable upon mine altar, for my house shall be called a house of prayer for all people.
God has set this apart in order to your spiritual blessing. You may not see it at the beginning, but neglect, contempt, profanation, carelessness, any kind of violation, any kind of transgression of the boundaries of the Sabbath day are expressions by the person doing that of a rejection of the spiritual blessings. If you wonder why the Sabbath is not any profit, it's not any delight to you, it's not helpful, it's not making your life better, the answer is you need to ask yourself what your attitude is with respect to the Sabbath. The last reason, or the last thing that makes this apparent, is that the Lord has even promised to make that day the spring of temporal blessings, not worldly loss. Look at Leviticus 25:20-22.
Leviticus 25, verse 20. And if you shall say, what shall we eat in the seventh year? Behold, we shall not sow nor gather in our increase. Verse 22. And you shall sow the eighth year, and eat yet of old fruit until the ninth year. Until her fruits come in, you shall eat of the old store.
God tells the Israelites that the Sabbath year that he had appointed for them, that he would take care of them during that year. You have no reason to believe that God's blessing is any less in temporal matters when it's one day out of a week and not one year out of seven. And God made up that temporal provision. The people who are worried that they're going to lose out on something need to understand that what is really happening is they're losing out of a lot more because they refuse to keep Sabbath. God is cursing them and removing from them much of the benefit of the other 6 days of the week because they're not honoring him in that seventh day. They're robbing him of his time, and he's going to plunder them of the very things that they're seeking by robbing him of his time. And the great capital of a nation is built upon the idea of saving and not expending everything. That is, giving rest even to capital. God has asked us to do that with regard to time. You know, when we spend everything that we have all the time, there's nothing left over. It's blasted. God wants us to form spiritual capital, to build the rest of the week from that. We shouldn't be looking at it, as I said before, we shouldn't be looking at it as what's left over at the end of the week. We should be looking at it as what is programmatic for what is to come. And so, if we look at it as sort of this ambulatory day where we can make up and catch up on our worldly affairs every week, what we do is we lose the blessing of God and provoke his anger. These reasons are given to us in this command. As I said before, we've got these extra reasons because this command has the least amount of natural morality in it. But at the same time, it also has, in some respects, the greatest promise in it for a people that follow in these ways. Because this is the command that sort of stands at the crossroads of helping us keep those first three commands to God aright, and also help us understand how it is we ought to be approaching our relations with our fellow men in the remaining six commandments. The next time, what we want to talk about is, in the next question, has to do with the word remember. What it means to remember the Sabbath day so that we can keep it holy unto the Lord. So that's what, Lord willing, we will talk about next time.
Stillwater's Revival Books is now located at PuritanDownloads.com. It's your worldwide online Reformation home for the very best in free and discounted classic and contemporary Puritan and Reformed books, MP3s, and videos. For much more information on the Puritans and Reformers, including the best free and discounted classic and contemporary books, MP3s, digital downloads, and videos, please visit Stillwater's Revival Books at PuritanDownloads.com. Stillwater's Revival Books also publishes the Puritan Hard Drive, the most powerful and practical Christian study tool ever produced. All thanks and glory be to the mercy, grace, and love of the Lord Jesus Christ for this remarkable and wonderful new Christian study tool. The Puritan hard drive contains over 12,500 of the best Reformation books, MP3s, and videos ever gathered onto one portable Christian study tool. An extraordinary collection of Puritan, Protestant, Calvinistic, Presbyterian, Covenanter, and Reformed Baptist resources. It's fully upgradable and it's small enough to fit in your pocket. The Puritan hard drive combines an embedded database containing many millions of records with the most amazing and extraordinary custom Christian search and research software ever created. The Puritan hard drive has been produced to assist you in the fascinating and exhilarating spiritual, intellectual, familial, ecclesiastical, and societal adventure that is living the Christian life. It has been specifically designed so that you might more faithfully know, serve, and love the Lord Jesus Christ, as well as to help you to do all you can to bring glory to His great name. If you want to love God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind, then the Puritan hard drive is for you. Visit PuritanDownloads.com today for much more information on the Puritan hard drive and to take advantage of all the free and discounted Reformation and Puritan books, MP3s, and videos that we offer at Stillwaters Revival Books.